coming up on This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Ark is with us. He has enormous experience doing live remote broadcasts in the field in lots of situations, local stations, regional, and network nationwide opportunities. Great advice is straight ahead on Twerked.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by the new Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twerked. And by Omnia 11, because great sound matters most. Now shipping with the new GeForce Dynamics engine as standard. Omnia 11, great sound matters most.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And it is delightful to be here with you. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Today, we've got a great show. It's on the whole subject of remote broadcasts. And we're going to be talking with a guest who has done a lot of these at the local level and the network level. We'll introduce him in just a few minutes. But you're going to get a lot of good advice on planning a live outside broadcast. Whether it's just voice or music involved, whatever it is, we've got some great advice for you on how to get that signal collected, get the audio mixed, and get it sent back to the network or to the radio station, whatever you're doing. So this is great advice for those engineers and interns who may be new at setting up remote broadcasts, whether it's for ball games, sporting events, a grand opening of a car dealership, or whatever it may be, or a live concert. And we're going to talk about live music, too. So that's all coming up on This Week in Radio Tech. So as I mentioned, I'm out of my usual studio. I'm in Riga, Latvia, and we've had some meetings here. The Telos Alliance is having some meetings here. We're training dealers and some other interested parties, presenting technology ideas, and really looking into the future. So that's it's been pretty exciting to be here. And it's midnight here. Actually, where I am, it's the next day. It's already June 1st, and everybody else on the show is suffering through Thursday. I'm already into Friday here in Riga, Latvia. And I wish it was a little earlier and I could show you outside. It's finally dark outside, but the sun doesn't set here until about 10 p.m. And then it takes almost an hour for the sky to get really dark because we're way up north here in Riga, Latvia. We're almost the same latitude as, say, St. Petersburg, Russia. Actually, we're just about even with Moscow. So, it's pretty interesting that what you get. And the sun, the morning daylight, even if you shut the curtains on the hotel room, light starts spilling in like an invader about 4:45 in the morning. So you get precious little sleep here during the summer because the sun is just really burning up into the hotel. So enough about this and where I am. Let's check in on Chris Tobin. Looks like he's coming to us from one of his usual hangouts in Newark, New Jersey. Hey, Chris.
Hello, Kirk. Yeah, I am. You know, it's funny you're talking about being there and it's already tomorrow. I feel like an episode of Doctor Who, some timey-wimey thing here. You know, I'm talking to you in the future.
Yeah. So, hey, how's – by the way, the weather here has been amazing. And sometimes we do chat about the weather as people are wont to do. There's a high pressure system over Scandinavia moving along kind of slowly. We've had clear skies, sunny skies, and amazing temperatures. Like during the day, it's getting up to about, 82, 85 degrees, something like that. It's just really nice. In the evenings, it's just, you walk down the boulevards. And actually, I said I'm in Riga, Latvia. That's not quite true. I'm about 10 miles from Riga in a beach town called Jurmala. And Jurmala, back in the day, back in the Soviet days, because the Soviet Union took over Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and then they each got their freedoms back in the mid-1980s. Anyway, Jurmala was a very popular place for higher-ups in the Communist Party from Moscow to come vacation because they don't have a beach in Moscow. But they have a beach here. And it's on the Baltic Sea. It's actually on the Gulf of Riga, which is right off the Baltic Sea. But it's salt water. And it's absolutely lovely here. And it's no wonder that those who were very well connected with the Kremlin or other higher-ups, maybe just other successful business people, certainly not the working class, but the higher-ups would come here on the new jet service back in the 1960s and have their vacations right here in Jurmala. So it's a beautiful, beautiful town. So anyway, that's my story. I'm sticking to it. Chris, how's the weather in the New York area today?
Well, in the New York area today, it's overcast skies. We've had rain on and off. As far as I can tell, it looks like a low pressure coming through and there's going to be some unsettled weather. I think tomorrow Oh, is it Saturday? Yeah, Saturday is when the rain's going to really hit and the high pressure is coming in and the temperatures are changing. So next couple of days, it's going to be sort of like Seattle. At least we had a musician in today and she was talking about how today reminded her, this week has reminded her of her time in Seattle. So it's overcast and a little drizzle here and there. It's about 68 degrees Fahrenheit right now.
Well, Chris, you have done a ton of remote broadcast yourself, and you've been involved at the network level in dealing with such things. Our guest, by the way, his first name is also Chris. So this, I think we'll figure out who we're talking to when we banter back and forth. Excuse me. But our guest is Chris Ark, A-R-K, Chris Ark. And he is in Michigan right now. Welcome in, Chris Ark. Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you. And Chris, why don't you just kind of give us the little elevator speech? You're just introducing yourself to our audience. Who is Chris Ark? And, you seem like a young guy, and yet you're pretty experienced with remote broadcast. Talk to us about Chris.
Well, you made me feel a bit old on your promotion of today's session because you said young-ish. It really helped hit home that I'm not a spring chicken anymore. But relatively, I'm really young in the game. You know, I'm only going to be going on 33 years old. Been doing broadcasting for about 10 years. Kind of got jumped into it by some mentors. My background was initially in live theatrical production, then kind of rolled over into live audio concert production. And then I saw a deficiency coming up as far as engineers coming up in the game that, you know, their hair keeps getting grayer and there's no one really to replace them. So I saw an opportunity to capitalize and get in while the getting's good. I originally started off in radio just being a board op for a syndicated radio show, home improvement radio show out of Arizona. And then from there, it opened up other opportunities to meet some chief engineers in the Phoenix area. I eventually got my chance to sweep floors, change light bulbs and change some transmitter filters, and finally got my first assistant gig over at which was Sandusky, and now it's Hubbard Radio there in Phoenix. From there, jumped on over to CBS Radio, their cluster there in Phoenix, and then kind of bounced back over to doing the live production stuff with the UFC, and now I'm kind of just doing contract work on my own, but I'm actually getting ready to move to Seattle here in a few days and start the next chapter of my career.
Awesome. Well, there's plenty of work to do in Seattle. I happen to know that, so I know you'll get busy there after you move there. And I believe earlier in the when we were talking before the show, you said you got a chance to work with quite a famous engineer. A lot of folks know him. It's Eric Schechter. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yes. Eric Schechter, he is a force to be reckoned with. He is the go-to for every issue that I might have that has a big question mark next to it. he doesn't always tell you what you want to hear, but he's going to tell you the truth and he's going to show you the way. So I owe a lot of my career to Eric. Absolutely.
So what turned me on to Chris Ark, folks, is an article that I came across. Chris, is your website CRA Audio? Is that you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Okay. So CRAAudio.com. And you have an article there that you wrote yourself. It's called Remote Broadcast Setups and Strategies for the Young Broadcast Engineer. And so I'm way too old to be reading this stuff, but you've got some great advice here. And I thought that, you know, for our show today, Chris, you could just kind of take us through your introduction, your pre-planning, your station feed and backhaul options, just some of the things that you've got in this article, and take us through, you know, with some degree of detail, leave our audience members with a sense of, basically almost remote broadcasting for dummies and a refresher for the rest of us, right? So I'll bet you know some tips and tricks that even, you know, guys like me who've done a ton of remote broadcast, you know, back in the landline and Marty days, that I can still learn some things. And then folks who are newer to the industry, that they can learn from you from mistakes, from good planning, and find out how to carry off a good remote broadcast. And so, Chris, while you're thinking about answering that, I should mention that our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is brought to you by a couple of terrific sponsors. First of all, the Telos Alliance, my employer. And we've got an important message from the Telos Alliance that has to do with remaining on their mailing list because of this this GDPR ruling, a rule that is going in effect in Europe, but any company that does business around the world has to comply with it. So don't want you to miss out on good stuff from the TELUS Alliance. So we'll talk about that. And also brought to you by the folks at Lavo at lavo.com/twert, where you'll find Lavo's whole line of products for the radio industry. And so we'll check it out there. We'll hear from each of these folks in just a few minutes. Chris Tobin. So I had not heard of Chris Ark until, I don't know, about a month ago or so, maybe 5-6 weeks ago, and really enjoyed reading his article. So Tim, I'll start with Chris Tobin for a second here. Chris, you've been involved with a ton of remotes, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I can say that I've done a lot. I've done my share, and they've been fun. They've been a learning experience. They have not all been successful. I will say that failure is not an option, but though when you do fail and realize why the next time you don't, I will say I've been, I've done some crazy stuff. I have a friend of mine who calls me from time to time and says, I'm trying to do a broadcast from a location. What is your suggestion? And I was like, where is it? And he tells me, I'm like, you might want to consider this, this, and this. He's like, why? That has nothing to do. Yeah, it has a lot to do with your setup. Trust me. And then after the event's over, he'll call me a month or two later. Yeah, you were right. I definitely shouldn't have done what you said not to do, and I did it anyway, and it failed. I was like, yeah, that's because I did it 3 times. I will say I've had my share. It's great times, good stuff, and locations around the world and right here in the States too. So it's been fun.
Oh, cool. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. And Chris, I remember you've talked to me about using all different manner of getting audio back from a remote site, having ISDN installed on a light standard, you know, in New York City, which apparently is a thing. You can have that done. I didn't know you could. Yeah. I didn't know you could. I thought it had to go into a house or a building.
If you know how to talk the language and you scope out, you do a site survey, you know, you go to your location for the broadcast in advance. And if you understand how the phone company functions and how their infrastructure is designed, you can get an ISDN circuit landed at a lamppost in New York City. Well, you couldn't back in the day. Nowadays, you're not going to get a squat.
Maybe not now.
I did ISDN. We did DSL. And DSL was an interesting one because there was two types of DSL in the day. That was what they used to call a dry DSL. And you say to yourself, what's the difference between dry and wet? Wet and audio would be reverb. Well, we're not putting reverb on the DSL. So it turns out that if you don't want to have a dial tone associated with the DSL circuit, which means another crazy billing situation, you can order it without dial tone and still have a seven-digit phone number attached to it.
Seven-digit phone number, no dial
and
tone.
By doing it that way, you avoid one of the internal departments in this case, Verizon, because of the way the tariffs are written for DSL and what they call retail phone service. So by not doing it and strictly staying within the business sector of the company, you can get DSLs in a lot of places that you wouldn't expect before. And we did a lot of stuff here in New York City. We did DSL to RF, ISDN to RF. We did microwave portable transmitters to wireless. I did 3 wireless hops in Times Square, which was interesting. That worked. That was a good one. Defied the laws of physics, according to some. And Mike Mason at CP Communications, I think if he remembers correctly, every time I call him and rented a gear from him, and I would ask him for certain types of antennas for the RF kits, he would ask, "Okay, I know we have them. No one's ever requested them before. What are you going to do with these things?" Like, after I'm set up and functioning, I'll send you pictures. And one of the pictures I sent to him was from a high atop of the Marriott Hotel across from the 9/11 pit, the former World Trade Center location back in the day for the first anniversary. And he calls me up and he's like, "Let me get this straight. You are using those wireless gear and your news reporters are on the street in the pit down below." I said, "Yeah." "And you're not having any issues?" I was like, "No, actually, I'm not. I'm actually using the physics of the receiver antenna and the filtering systems and the way they function, and it's working out just nicely." He's like, "Okay, all right, got it. We're going to make a kit then for you from now on when you call. Just give it this kit number, and we'll ship it to you. Don't even worry about assembling it." And that's the kind of remote stuff that I've done. You practice, you learn. What was that Clint Eastwood line? "Man's got to know his limitations."
That's right. So we got to hear this whole story.
And I know there's a lot of folks out there listening going, "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah." You need to understand the limitations of the technology, the venue, the people you're working with, the equipment you decide to take, and the time frame in which you need to work. And once you have that under control, or at least within some control, I'm pretty sure you could have a 99% success rate of your remotes. I'm sure Chris Ark would probably agree with that.
Well, we're going to find out. So with that buildup, and Chris has done plenty of this stuff. Chris, again, welcome into the show. I'm looking forward to hearing about your planning. And I guess planning is the first part of this. You've probably planned a number of different kinds of remotes, but I'm not sure where you want to start the conversation, Chris. So start it wherever you like, and we're going to sit back and listen and learn.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, Chris hit it on the head. You know, preparation is you know, the biggest factor to doing this, site check, because you don't know what variables you're going to run into, you know, regardless if you're running, you know, IP, ISDN, hardline, wireless, you know, there's all sorts of different factors that you need to get figured out during that site check. And two most important things for me when going in there is power. And how am I getting audio to and from the broadcast studio? Because without that, there is no remote broadcast. You might as well get on your cell phone and do a good old call in. So, with power, if we could, you know, start there, you know, being an audio guy, more amperage, the better for me, because, you know, coming from a live background, you know, when that kick drum hits and that hits your amp, you know, you need to make sure you have plenty of amperage there. So I'm always trying to seek out the 20 amp circuit wherever I'm going to be broadcasting from. Now, odds are, you're not going to probably be provided with a 20 amp circuit. So 15 amp circuit should be more than enough to power all of your equipment. But you know, other things you have to consider when you're looking at power is it a shared circuit? Do you have a dedicated circuit? If not, say that you're doing a remote broadcast out on a plaza for a big concert. Well, there's going to be Radio Row and you might not have a PA set up, but the station down the way might have a PA set up. And if they really crank that thing up, your broadcast could go down like that. So you need to be aware of who's using that circuit. Also helps to know how much power or amperage your equipment is pulling initially. So just so that way you have some frame of reference going into it, knowing this is my bare minimum requirement for power. And you could do that by, you know, setting all your equipment up in your shop and then putting an amp clamp on the power conditioner that you're plugging everything into. So, power considerations are huge, because without power, I mean, unless you have a self-contained, you know, access unit, NX unit, where, you know, you have a battery built in. But most of my broadcasts that I do, they're day-long broadcasts. And this article was really written around country music festival that I go out and do production management for, called Country Thunder, out in Florence, Arizona, with Entercom Radio, formerly CBS. A lot of this article, it applies to bigger remote broadcasts, but a lot of the things that are touched on are really universal, regardless if it's a van stop, car dealership, or a 4-day long broadcast. And regardless of which one you're at, you need power.
Chris, if you go to the Ford dealership, if the radio station sells a remote, the Ford dealership, and you go out and scope it out, you know, there's nobody in charge of the power, really. I mean, there's no electrician on duty. So it's up to you, the engineer, to figure out, okay, that plug looks good. I hope there's nothing else, you know, on this circuit. No big printer or something else is going to suck down a lot of power. Hope the janitor doesn't come by and plug in his vacuum cleaner during the remote. But you're on your own. But when you go to a venue that's more professionally managed, and maybe you even get a chance beforehand to meet, you know, those management people, then is that a situation where you get to request, hey, I need 20 amps here. I need 220 amp drops over here. Is anybody else going to be on this? Do you get to arrange that kind of stuff beforehand?
I mean, again, it's venue specific. You know, like you said, if you're going to a car dealership, kind of what you get is what you get, and you pray for the best. But you know, if you go to like a Live Nation venue, I mean, they have, you know, 400 amp service just for one half of the building. So odds are you're going to be able to work with the in-house staff to, you know, really lay out your requirements and get it taken care of ahead of time. But sometimes that's still not an option. So
you ever take I know they can be kind of heavy, but do you ever take a big UPS with you in case in the middle of a nationwide or a big broadcast, your power goes out and you're at least prepared for a few minutes? You got a few minutes to scramble.
Oh, absolutely. I have APC UPSs, the big rack mount units at pretty much every broadcast location I have out at Country Thunder. If it's a smaller car dealership, I'll bring one of the little small brick units out with me just so I have some sort of reaction time. So, it's really dependent on the size of the venue of what UPS I bring with me, but absolutely.
That's a great idea. I had never thought of bringing a UPS to a venue until you mentioned power concerns. So, okay, that's something to add to the toolbox or the budget request so you can at least have a few minutes of power if you get kicked off. Yeah.
And remember to test that UPS before you take it out with you, because those batteries might be on the hairy edge of just going dead on you, and that's the last thing you want. So, again, preparation, preparation, preparation.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so when you go to a venue to scope it out, you've talked about power. What else are you looking for?
Well, one other thing I want to mention on power, which is it's overlooked quite a bit, is where are you running your power cables? Is it granny-proofed, as in, you know, are people going to be tripping over it? But almost more importantly, two things. Where are you running that cable? Are you running it across a door threshold where that metal door could expose the conductors of that cable and then potentially electrify that door? You know, I've seen, you know, copper strands poking right out of a cable that I've seen PAs using before, and my heart just about stopped. So you want to be cognizant of where you're placing your cables for safety's sake. The other thing that I've noticed is, you know, people use extension cables with no ground pins on them. That's a really big bugaboo for me, because, you know, if that equipment becomes electrically hot for whatever reason, that current needs a place to go, which is ground, instead of electrifying that equipment. So if you go to tweak a knob and accidentally touch the metal chassis of that unit, you know, that can become electrified and you get a little bit of a shock there. So that's, you know, again, the last thing that we want to do.
Okay.
And then the last thing on power is, I've seen people totally unplug my extension cable, killing my broadcast, to simply plug in a cell phone, you know, the on-air talent to plug in their cell phone. So, word of the wise and from experience, deploy a power strip specifically with a sign that says cell phone charging, and your issues will probably go away with that.
You make it obvious. That's great. Because if you don't, yeah, Somebody could pull that power. Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, cell phone charging.
So in closing on power, you know, there's other stuff. You know, take a non-contact voltage tester with you, or a three-prong tester to make sure that, you know, you're getting ground, because there could be an issue with that circuit. And the last thing you want to do is find out when the unit has become electrically hot. And then have a voltmeter with you. Even if you don't know what all these little dials do here and all these little functions, at the very least, you should know what the AC voltage portion of it does. Test how much voltage is coming into your equipment, because if you're over or under, you know, say between 110 and 120 volts, you know, that equipment can do some pretty funky stuff. And you don't want to find out when you're in the middle of an interview with, say, you know, Brooks and Dunn, or, you know, Brantley Gilbert. You know, that's the last thing you want to do, is have your equipment go down.
Well, and I suppose with all the different power standards that there are, it's conceivable if somebody's, you know, tapping you into some power, you know, even a somewhat qualified person, they could accidentally pop you into 277 volts, you know, or 240. There ought to be 125 volts. That's a great idea. Is be sure you just check for the voltage before you plug into it. If it's in a home or in a business, that outlet's probably been used over and over again. And if there was a problem there, it would have gotten figured out before you got to it. But at a temporary venue where they're running temporary lines, even in, let's say, a trade show environment, those are, you know, they're temporary. They're put in just for the trade show. Now, they've done this over and over again, but still, that's a great idea. Take 10 seconds and measure that voltage.
You know, mistakes happen, and the last thing you want to do is find out a mistake on your own when it comes to power. crummy audio is one thing, but when you're dealing with power in people's lives, no remote broadcast is worth somebody getting hurt over.
So I want to remind folks who are listening or watching, this is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 397. Chris Ark is our guest, and we kind of took a few minutes to get going, but Chris is talking about scoping out a remote site to do a live remote broadcast, and we've covered power. We got a lot more to cover, but we also need to take a quick break and tell you about the folks who make this broadcast possible, this podcast possible. And first of all, it's our friends at the Telos Alliance. Now, I'm going to tell you about the Telos Alliance, and remember our Direct Current. This is a weekly e-newsletter that goes out to people all over the world. And here's a copy of it right here. This is from just a couple weeks ago. Why broadcasters like you love AOIP, audio over IP. Every week you're going to find 2, 3, 4 articles in there, plus a listing of some of the events coming up for broadcast engineers down toward the bottom. If you want to scroll on that, scroll through that Suncast, you're welcome to. But these are always articles of interest. Yes, some of them are specifically about Telos. Some are about, hey, we found, this bug in the software. Here's an announcement. You need to update software on this piece of equipment or that piece of equipment. Like right there, the free OmniVolt update that we've been talking to our dealers about. So now we're up to 1.218. It's a free update for the OmniVolt. And then here, upcoming events, COBA in Seoul, South Korea. Actually, that just passed because this is a few weeks old. The AES convention in Milan just finished up. The Western Association of Broadcasters Conference in Alberta, Canada. Infocom is coming up next week in Las Vegas, Nevada. So there may be something going on near you that you want to see. Well, guess what? You're not going to get Direct Current anymore at all, unless you go to our website or have answered positively in an email that you may have gotten from the Telos Alliance. You may have noticed that you're getting a lot of emails saying, hey, we've updated our privacy policy. You need to click here if you want to continue getting emails from us. And look, I know your email box is stuffed. There's all kinds of stuff you don't want. And I'm just hoping you do want the Telos Alliance Direct Current newsletter. I find it valuable. You know, I'm a broadcast engineer too. Well, go to this page, and actually there is a shortcut for this page. It's telosalliance.com/opt-in. No punctuation there, just OPTIN. Telosalliance.com/opt-in. And hey, please, let's stay in touch. Because of these rules from the European Union, basically, we have to get explicit permission from people who are members of the EU, certainly, to continue to email them. And, Telos Alliance is all over the world. And so it's really hard to tell, where people are for sure. So you got to do this, whether you're in the EU or not. Go to telosalliance.com/opt-in, and you'll just fill in your email address there and let us know that you want to continue to hear from the Telos Alliance. I'm telling you this because it's important. We appreciate all the people like you who have been getting Direct Current and other emails from the Telos Alliance. We really are sensitive. We don't like to get spammed ourselves, so we're sensitive to send you things that are valuable that we think you can use. And, of course, you're not obligated to read them. But if you want to continue receiving the information, and, hey, we've got full-time staffers putting this information together, writing articles about software updates, new techniques, some of it kind of nostalgia. We do some nostalgia articles from time to time, Found in the Attic, and a lot of cool stuff. Sometimes we get updates on technology from people like Frank Foti, Greg Shea, Jeff Stedman, Cornelius Gould. So Marty Sachs has written some articles as well. And if you want to keep getting the stuff, you've got to tell us actively and positively that you want to opt in. So telosalliance.com/opt-in, O-P-T-I-N, email address. And the box is already checked, so that's done. And then click the button. And you may notice that our page of policy is kind of long. Yeah, there's lawyers involved. There's lawyers involved to make sure that we are absolutely legal, because I got to tell you, you've been getting all these messages from different companies because the fines from the European Union are unbelievably substantial. And the Telos Alliance, we don't want to waste any money paying fines. So we want to make sure that you're informed and we have your consent to send you emails. And with that consent, we're going to keep telling you about the great stuff of the Telos Alliance, like the gear behind me right over here. There's an Omnia 11 with the new GeForce 3.5 upgrade. It's pretty amazing. It has the new Peppino Clipper in it from Frank Foti's Cat. Or is that from East Wind? That might be from East Wind, his train. And then we have an Axia Fusion here behind me on a big screen. And actually, I'm in a room full of all kinds of gear, but I'm not going to get up and move everything around. I've got a couple of audio processors behind me turned off because they have big fans in them. Normally, they might go to transmitter side or in a rack room, and I just didn't want all the fan noise going on right here. So check us out, if you would, TELUSalliance.com. And remember to opt in at TELUSalliance.com/opt-in. Thanks a lot to the TELUS Alliance for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Tobin is along, as almost he always is, and Chris Ark is with us. Let's jump right back, Chris Ark, into prepping for remotes.
Sure. What's the next step is, you know, what piece of equipment are we going to be using to get the audio to and from the studio? So, I mean, there are, you know, dozens of manufacturers, but, you know, some of the keystones there are what, Telos with the Zip unit, Comrex with the Access and their new NX series, Tyline, and then obviously the Lucy Live Lite complement to a lot of these units. I primarily use, if I'm running IP, Comrex Access, and that's really a choice of whatever company I'm typically working with at that time. But, you know, for my broadcast that I do out at this 4-day festival, my primary is actually an ISDN because it's stable. The circuit's already in place and it's dedicated bandwidth with CD quality. But, you know, you guys were speaking on earlier, odds are if there is an ISDN line there, which is costly, you're going to be running IP codec. So you have to look at, okay, where am I? Can I run 4G if that's my only option? If that is your only option, be aware that, you know, when you do your site check a few days ahead of time, you might be perfectly good to go. There's, you know, little to no jitter or latency. But once, you know, 1,000 people or, you know, 5,000 people converge at that venue, they're all going to be on that 4G network, sucking up bandwidth. So when I have the option, I prefer to go hardwire internet connection. Because you're not sharing a pipe with somebody or as many people, and there's less room for interference of your actual connection. Now, the one thing that I really, really like about IP codecs is that there's so many features that allow aiding and combating network congestion, jitter, delay. One is forward error correction where, you know, it sends a secondary stream to and from. So that way, if the packets get lost, which inevitably, you know, they're going to get lost somewhere, you have a secondary stream of packets to be able to make up for those lost packets on that primary stream. New thing, I'm not sure how long it's been around, but is the multiple network bonding that you can do to increase your overall bandwidth. So if you have a Verizon card, Sprint card, you can mux those together to get a bigger pipe if you have to go with a 4G model. Another cool thing about IP codecs is the agile codec connection. So say that, you know, when you first start your remote broadcast, you know, you have a pipe that allows you to run, let's say, PCM linear or AACLD, you know, to get a really crisp, clear, just in-person sounding audio, that's great. But if that network becomes congested, you need to be able to relegate that codec back that's able to run on the bandwidth that's allotted to you at that time. So that's huge as far as keeping a stable connection going.
You know, you're talking about codec technology, and that is how most remote broadcasts are done. Of course, an ISDN codec is a codec. You are absolutely stuck with either 56, 64 kilobits, 112 kilobits, or 128 kilobits per second, depending on your ISDN configuration. Unless some ISDN codecs would do multiple lines, but that gets pretty expensive. You mentioned even possibly doing PCM linear, and this is pretty interesting. More and more places that stations go to, they got the bandwidth to do linear point to point. And I know that the Cleveland Symphony Orchestra has been doing this with the classical station in Cleveland. And during the Sochi Olympics, I realize that's been over 4 years ago now, they were actually having trouble with their ISDN getting out of Sochi, Russia. And so some of the networks were, some were using Zip Ones or other brands of IP codecs. And some people were using just an Axia node, like an Axia X node, put it into unicast mode rather than multicast mode. And that way they can just point it at an IP address and a port number somewhere else, like, oh, say, Sweden, and get a linear 24-bit stereo 48 kilohertz sampled broadcast. So, I mean, like, really perfect audio quality. It's hard to do better.
Yeah.
And real time. So, and we're at this point in technology, and I know you know this better than anybody, but I'll just make the point, where you might, you know, your best connection might be a shaky 4G connection, or it might be fiber, and you've just got terrific connectivity. Our new station in Hawaii that I've just been building, we've got gigabit fiber there, and we've got really good internet here in Riga, Latvia. I've been getting literally about 100 megabits per second between here in Riga and in Kauai, in the village of Lihue. So, you can do a lot with 100 megabits per second. Now, there's going to be some packet drops, packet loss here and there, so it's good to have codecs that make up for that, and linear doesn't typically, unless you have the technology, the forward error correction you were talking about. But my point is, we're at this point in technology where you kind of got to be ready for anything. And it sounds like that's part of what you're planning for, being ready for about anything.
Well, absolutely. And again, with this particular broadcast that this article is based on, it's in the middle of the desert, in the middle of nowhere. So you need to make sure you have all your redundancy in place, because when it comes to as far as the PD is concerned, there's no excuses once he has all of his on-air staff out there doing a four-day remote broadcast. You have to be able to deliver. And that's part of the job as a remote broadcast engineer, is to anticipate the unexpected. So that way you're going to be a hero when the time comes where you go, we have an issue, but we took care of it. Don't worry. Go do your thing.
Do you typically bring equipment out in short equipment racks or stack stuff on top of each other? Well, what's your physical setup look like?
Well, I mean, if we're doing just a car dealership or, you know, a Circle K van stop, typically I'll just send them out with a Comrex access with the complimentary mixer, built-in battery pack. So, you know, again, power probably isn't going to be much of a concern. But again, for these bigger broadcasts, yeah, I have two broadcast racks that I bring out. And, you know, that's the next step of this. You know, once you figure out your power and codec requirements and how you're going to be getting to and from, next thing is, what are your production requirements? What equipment do you have available to you? So for this big broadcast that I do, I know some people have the luxury of having, you know, Axia nodes out there. Me, I'm rocking old school analog consoles, you know, with matrices routing and aux sends. But, you know, that's the next step of it. What are your production requirements? And talk to your production, talk to your PD and your digital department to find out, you know, how many microphones do we need? You know, are we going to need sound effect playback on site? You know, do we need to import field audio? You need an audio console that's going to be able to accept all those inputs and spit out enough outputs to make it a successful broadcast. So like console inputs, you know, microphone, station backhaul, feed, return, sound effects. You know, I have Vox Pro out on site for my remote broadcasts that are larger. And, you know, some of these broadcasts, I do artist performance as well. So you need to be prepared for that.
At this big country music festival that you mentioned, was it called Thunder Country?
Country Thunder, yeah.
I'm sorry, Country Thunder. Are you mixing, are you taking a feed off of a house feed for the mixed music on stage?
No, so what we do, we actually have a condo that's just a broadcast condo where we come and have the artists do interviews. They might hook up an acoustic guitar for a personal little performance. But no, gotcha. No, we don't take the main stereo bus feed from there. On the point of setup, you know, once you figure out, you know, how many ins and outs do I need? How many cameras am I going to be feeding? Draw it out on paper to figure out, you know, is this signal flow going to work properly? Are we going to have feedback issues? And not only that, but is a normal board op or on-air talent going to be able to operate this robust setup that you just did? Because if it's so complicated that no one can run it, well, you probably didn't do it right. So you might have to scale things back a little bit.
I'm sorry. Yeah, here's a question about remote broadcast. Whether it's a car dealership, a county fair, or a large broadcast. So let's say you've got a broadcast center where you know one person or maybe several people are, but then you've got maybe somebody out in the field, somebody at the other end of the car lot, or somebody over at the pony rides at the fair, or somebody in another red carpet booth or some, or at the red carpet at some awards event. What are some of the ways that you would connect audio back and forth with that person who's not very far away? They may be 100 feet away. They may be 1,000 feet away. What are some techniques? Sure. And while you're answering that, do you necessarily need to bring that audio back to, let's say, wherever your main broadcast is emanating from? I mean, at the remote site.
Right.
Or could that person just be on a separate line back to the studio and let somebody at the studio mix that in, take them in and out of the broadcast?
Right. Well, as far as having them on separate units, let's just use the access rack unit as an example. Some stations, they might only have one access rack unit, but you still have to get, audio from, let's say, the live performance tent all the way back to the broadcast condo. So, in this instance, depending on how far away they are, I might just deploy a wireless microphone with, some parasitic antennas, coming off the wireless receivers. But say that it's not within the range of using a wireless mic out at this festival. I actually deploy Ubiquiti rocket links. So what I'll do is I'll actually take an IP codec, put it on a 192 address, and have a brick link at one site, and then have a brick link over at the broadcast condo to bridge that gap.
Wow. Hey, Chris Tobin has a little bit of experience with doing remotes that way, don't you, Chris?
Well, I was going to say that sounds awfully familiar. That paper I presented pretty much talked about that. And I'm glad somebody else was thinking of it. That makes total sense. That's a good way to do it.
Yeah.
Chris Ark, you mentioned a specific Ubiquiti model. So what is this looking like, the Ubiquiti gear that's used locally for a local short shot?
I can't remember. They're just the Ubiquiti, maybe they're nanos. The real small units that you can put up on a hurry up mast, power over Ethernet down into a switch. Nothing fancy. Pretty simple setup overall.
Kirk, it's the same ones we used at PREC.
Yeah. At PREC.
For the show.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Well, we have
okay.
a ketchup bottle, but yes.
I was going to say, is this the that's how I know it. Is this the one that fits on a ketchup bottle?
That's correct. You are correct, sir.
Oh, Ubiquiti. I want the same model that Chris Tobin hooks to a ketchup bottle for stability. That's a little secret, Chris Ark, that Chris Tobin has. Ketchup bottle has the right amount of ballast to hold that up while you're sitting at your dining table doing a live remote broadcast.
I didn't know that. I did not know that.
Yeah. See, I think mustard bottle may work, too. Yeah, it's got to be full. Okay, so you have this kind of planning going on. You've picked your codec, and I think we're at such a cool point in technology where, I realize people have budgets. If you've got a Telezip One, if you've got a Comrex Access or NX or Tyline product, you've got your codec, and we know that this codec technology has gotten pretty good, and a lot of them are pretty good at mitigating problems. You were talking about mitigation. If your available data path is varying quite a bit, the benefit of agile data rate on your codec is this: if it's not agile, then you kind of need to set the codec for the lowest bit rate that you think your path will handle, and you've got to leave it at that the whole time. And so if you
and make sure you leave a little bit of a buffer too, utilize maybe about 80-85% of that bandwidth, because you want a little headroom there so you don't totally lose all packets.
And so with agile technology, you could run at 384 kilobits per second of AAC coding, and if things got bad, it'll kick into high efficiency AAC and kick it on down to some low bit rate if you had to. And I'm sure other products do it too, but I know that the Telos Zip One does this very well. Steps to different bit rates as the need arises. What's exciting though, and I'm glad we're finally at this point in technology where The available data rate at so many locations is just getting better and better and better. Now, I realize if you're out in a stadium with 100,000 other people, you know, you may have some pretty crummy data on your cell phone. And we actually heard about a solution to this a couple weeks ago with a guy named Josh Bone talking about a service called Max Connect. That's a branded service, but they've purchased QoS service through Verizon. And they said, we can be sitting there with a rock solid half a meg per second or more, whatever we've arranged for, while everybody else around us has little or no connectivity. And we're all using Verizon. Yeah. So that kind of 4G LTE connectivity with QoS is becoming a reality and becoming available to broadcasters for a price. But it's available. But I own a cabin in the woods in East Tennessee, in the mountains, and I get 60 megs down and about 12 megs up from my cable provider, and it's pretty rock solid. We do the show from there when I'm at the cabin. So, I mean, and this is – it's pretty bad switchback roads to get up there. You know, it's away from civilization. So if there's more places where we're getting the kind of bandwidth where here's a dirty little secret. Someday in the future – I think Telos and Comrex and Tyline are kind of going to be out of the codec business because we're going to have enough bandwidth on normal, what are then become normal connections to get linear audio out. Now, we still may need some techniques for reliability, but I think it's going to be pretty common. I don't mean tomorrow, but you know, down the road, hey, how much could happen in 5 years with 5G LTE coming out? I mean, what if it was just amazing? So anyway, I'm sorry, didn't mean to slow you down. I'm sure there's a lot more to talk about and practice and get ready for on your broadcasts. Howdy.
Yeah, so once you have your codec requirements all figured out, and you know what audio console that you're going to be using. Probably it's going to be a live broadcast console. The next thing for me is microphone selection. Really, the first factor of microphone selection is what's available to you at your radio station. It might just be a Shure SM58. You might have some RE20s, 27s laying around. There's been a few broadcasts where I've had the luxury of using a Neumann TLM-103, or I have a few Rode broadcasters I can bring out, but it takes careful consideration on what microphones am I going to use. If you're going to be in a dusty, damp, windy, noisy environment, that's what I automatically default to, a large diaphragm dynamic microphone like an RE20, RE27, because it can withstand that, just that abuse, the off-axis rejection. It is good to get rid of that ambient noise. And then say that you want to use a condenser microphone like this one here. You know, if it's a noisy environment, really windy, well, it's going to pick up every little sound that's around that immediate area. And another thing to consider if you're thinking about using a condenser microphone is think about how the capsule is actually made. You have a back plane right here, and then in front of it, you have that diaphragm. Well, in between those, you know, you have potential. You have voltage going in there, because that's what actually creates a signal, is the difference in the voltage when you're talking into the microphone. Well, that's more or less a capacitor, right? So if moisture, dust gets in there, this capsule can short out and you're not even going to get any audio out of it. And if you do, it's going to be less than desirable sonic quality. So it's just one thing to think about when you think you're going to be fancy and, oh, I'm going to bring out a condenser microphone to this broadcast. Well, what's your broadcast environment? You got to really think about that.
So dynamics control could be pretty important at a remote site. You know, it's hard enough to get air talent to pay attention to the level meters, and that's part of why we tend to use mic processing in the studios. Do you plan on – do you use mic processing out in the field where they may even be paying less attention to levels?
Oh, absolutely. But with the caveat, if we're doing a van stop or something like that, where a promotions assistant's going to set this up, I'm just going to send them out with some 58s and a little Comrex mixer. But for this broadcast, absolutely. I gravitate towards the Aphex products. I actually still use the Legacy 230s out in the field there, because it's, you know, it's great. You know, they have built-in EQ, compression, the RL exciter, and the gating. So again, when you're doing a multi-day broadcast with your on-air talent, the PD wants that to sound as polished as possible. They don't want to hear a Yamaha analog console mic pre. They want it broadcast quality right out of the gate. Now, that being said, not everybody is afforded that luxury of being able to rip out $1,000 mic processors out of their studios to take them out to a dusty environment. So, I mean, there's some analog consoles out there, even digital consoles, if you're running one of those, that have built-in compression, that have some dynamic control. So, no, absolutely. You know, sometimes, you know, on-air talent, they'll be talking like this, and next thing you know, they're back here like this, off access to the mic, and they totally disappear. it's amazing to me that, you know, that's their job, but they're, you know, they're talking way over here on the mic when they should be right here. So dynamic control is huge.
What about using sports headsets? Now, I own four sets of those, and when this show, this podcast, is on the road, sometimes we all don sports headsets and go through a little cheap mixer and use that, because then then our hands are free. We don't have to worry at all about the mic because it's going to be right there the whole time. When is a sports headset appropriate? Obviously for sports, but when else?
You know what? To be honest with you, Kirk, I don't use a lot of sports headsets, but you know, if I have a certain talent that I know that likes to move around a lot, you know, they're constantly going like this. I'll try to persuade them to put on like a Sennheiser sports headset or something, but it's met with a lot of resistance. Not quite sure why, but they're creatures of habit. Not much experience with trying to deploy those.
If you can get the play-by-play announcers to do your remote broadcast, I'll bet they're willing to wear sports headsets.
Oh, I bet they are. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Maybe not so much the morning team, but the play by play people should be willing to. I know it helps us out, and in a noisy environment, because most of them have really good noise rejection. And because if you've done a broadcast from a basketball court, you know how incredibly noisy a basketball arena can be, and sure, you've got to be able to hear those announcers.
And odds are most of those capsules, and please correct me if I'm wrong, they're probably hypercardioid, so it has a lot of off access rejection. Correct.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yep.
So, one of the last topics we'll get to is ventilation, because I'm
absolutely
really glad you included that in your paper. But before we get to that topic to consider last, is there anything else you want to bring up about planning and actually now executing remote broadcasts? Like, you know, during the broadcast, what do you need to watch out for, be cautious of, be careful of, or handle before it becomes a problem?
You know what, again, where's your power coming from? Know where your power is coming from, because again, I hate to keep going back to it, but this country music festival that I do, the reason I have my primary backhaul feed is my ISDN is because it's independent of any power that I'm being provided. My Ubiquiti links that provide me my internet 50 symmetrical backhaul is tied to a breaker panel that has 7 or 8 Prevost tour buses.
The big tour buses.
Oh yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
They're all plugged in shore power with. All right.
You betcha. Yeah. So know where your power is coming from and know who your contacts are. Don't wait to be in the heat of the moment. And go, oh, who's the power guy? Who do I need to get in touch with? Make those relationships ahead of time, so you already have them on speed dial in your phone. They know to expect you when and if something comes up, and have tech support on hand too for whatever service provider that you're using too. CenturyLink, they've always been really good to me, to get out and repair any issues if there's ever been any issues.
I was just going to say, this is a good point for Chris Tobin to come in, because Chris has often chided us, warned us, and encouraged us to have these numbers handy for, you know, anything that you're depending on along the way. Make sure you know how to contact them quickly and easily, so you're not fumbling to look for that when you've got an emergency going on. And I wonder, besides just the phone numbers, seems like, you know, if you know somebody's name, a manager's name, or are there any other keywords to say we're doing a live broadcast, we're nationwide on the, I mean, does that make any difference or not to the people answering the phone with entering a trouble ticket, whether it's for internet or power or telephone or whatever the service may be that you're looking for? What's some advice about not only having the numbers, but having other information that would help you get it fixed quickly.
Yeah, know your menu options. Have those written down already. Press 1, 2, 5, 9 to get to the media bureau desk for them to resolve issues. Because odds are, if you're deploying a service like this, you're going to have a QoS. So the last thing they want to do is hear from you. And if they do hear from you, they want to be able to get it resolved. So, know the menu options and know who to talk to. Always have your, in the instance of ISDN, have your SPID numbers available, have your circuit number available. And the same can be said in the world of IP of know your, what's my IP addresses, what's my subnet mask and my DNS, all that stuff. Have all that right available. Because if you call a tech up, at Verizon or whatever your IP provider might be, if you read off a list of all my subnets, XYZ, they might go, oh, that's wrong. We need to get that corrected. And then boom, all of a sudden you're up and rolling. So know your circuit info.
Gotcha. Chris Tobin, you have anything to add to that?
Oh yeah, I will add to the following one. Yes, it does help when you call the support desk that the show that you're calling about, the service interruption for the show you're broadcasting may have a high profile, talent. I will tell you that 2 weeks ago, we had one of our ISDN circuits just go belly up literally the morning of a broadcast we're going to do that evening with the governor's office, the governor of New Jersey. And I did not use that card on the call to Verizon, who is the carrier, at first. I called, told him the circuit's down hard. We've got the situation. Here are the SPIDs. Here's the circuit ID. Here's even the underground cable number. I have all that information. And then they tell me, well, our commitment, meaning the next available service call, will come on date X. I'm like, well, that's the day after the event that we're trying to do. She goes, well, I understand, but we're kind of backlogged. I said, well, I have to now sort of up the ante on this situation. And she's like, what do you mean? The circuit is for the broadcast for the governor's Ask the Governor show on tomorrow night. Is there any way we can, increase priority? That afternoon, I had two techs, splicing team on site. They were very nice about it. It doesn't happen often, but they understood the severity. I said, look, I'm playing this card because I don't know what else to tell you because I understand where you're coming from, but you got to help me. The CEO is literally 4 blocks from this building, so there's got to be some way somebody can get to help us. We're not out in the middle of nowhere, so it's got to be. And they came out and they took care of it. And I will say they were very up on it, and the team that came out, one of the guys is like, so this is for the governor's show? I was like, yeah, it's one of the circuits for the show. He goes, okay, got it. And they went on their merry way.
Got a name drop once in a while.
Well, it was a situation where they literally told me, we can't get anybody out to you until the day after the need of the circuit. I'm like, that's not going to work. So we had 2 days to work with, and they were nice about it. So, yes, it does help. The other thing, when you're doing circuits, say in the case of IP, because we're all doing a lot of that now, sure, when you place the order, if it's a DSL or it's a cable modem drop or whatever you choose, make sure you ask them, if you're doing a static IP, make sure it's a static single IP, or if it's a range, make sure they give you the range. Ask them to give you what range they've assigned. The net mask will tell you the range or the number of IP addresses you have. All that information, as Chris pointed out, you definitely need to have on hand. What I do is I print it out on a small little piece of paper, then I attach it to the codec that's going to be using that information. Why? Because I may not be there while one of my guys is, and the problem may occur. He can look down and verify the information in the codec matches what's on the label. So that sort of shortens the time between troubleshooting and panic, and that helps. So keep that in mind. Matter of fact, we do a show here every month with the mayor's office, and it involves going offsite and using vMix to do our Facebook Live stuff. And the computer that we travel with, I actually have on it the sticker for the IP addresses that we've been assigned for the show at the venue that we go to every month. And it paid off because one day I had to step away, and one of the other guys called and said, hey, we can't connect. It's good. There's no internet service on the computer. What do we do? I said, just look at the little piece of paper, open up the network properties, verify that it's not on DHCP and it's static IP. Sure enough, there was a digit off. It's problem solved. Literally 10 minutes, they were back up and running, ready for the show. I know it seems simple. It may seem like, wow, that's crazy. That's stupid. Why not do this? Don't get the crazy thing with using your iPhone or your Android phone as the source for all information. Stick the paper
those
on the
can
equipment.
Go dead.
They can go dead, or you got to sit there and scroll through your papers and expand the image and go, then you have to put it down. If it's taped to the codec, you literally are looking at the codec while both hands are free, typing in the information on your laptop, if that's your method, or the front panel.
Yeah.
Try it sometime.
Cool. That's a great idea. And Chris, I got one follow-up question though. The way you're talking, you're kind of implying that the codec is being attached to the DSL circuit without without a router between it and the DSL. Is that what's happening?
That's a possibility. Maybe you're in a venue that you're already behind a firewall and they're giving you IP addresses. Okay. So in the case of the mayor's show, we are behind the firewall. It is a local IP, but we've been assigned the IP address to our Mac on the computer that we've said we'll use every month. So these are other things you can do. If you have recurring broadcasts and you're working with a venue and the IT department, they're more than happy to work with you if you can tell them or at least offer up, hey, can we assign the Mac to the IP so you don't have to create a separate list? See, not every place, it's not easy maintaining a static IP list on a huge network. So a lot of IT administrators will say no to static IP. But if you offer up the MAC address and say that this is what I'm going to use every time I connect to your network, then they'll say, okay, tell you what, we'll assign the IP to MAC. We're good. Thank you very much. The reservation is now set up that fashion. They don't have to create a list. That's something also so understand who you're dealing with and how their operation is working, because you can't ask them to change this. Most IT departments and most venues that you're going to go to as a broadcaster have no idea of the mission critical need of what you're doing. So you have to sort of educate them, but in a very low impact way.
We have
Go ahead. I was going to say, just make sure you communicate with their IT departments, the ports that you might need opened for that codec to talk back and forth. Cause there's, I mean, you know, a casino, you know, a larger venue, they have their network locked down as tight as they possibly can. So, you know, make sure you know what ports you need to have opened up for that particular flavor of codec.
Good advice, especially, you know, a lot of us are used to a home environment or a small business environment where outgoing ports are no problem. It's incoming that are blocked, except for ones that you might forward here and there. But in a university setting, in a large corporate setting, outgoing stuff is going to be blocked too, unless they unblock it. Or I was at a university where you could go outgoing, but it would shut back down within a few seconds. And it just turned out that the IT department needed to increase that time on the IP addresses that we were using so that they wouldn't shut down before a keep alive packet was sent. Hey, we got to take a quick break and be back with kind of a big tip of the week, which from Chris Ark's point of view is going to be about ventilation. You wouldn't believe how important that is, especially if you're out in the hot sun doing a live remote broadcast and your equipment is in black cases. Oh my gosh, this can be a serious problem. So we'll be back. We're going to hear from our friends at Lavo at lavo.com/tort, and we'll be right back with the show.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the Jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo Radio Tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to Lavo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. And if this technology appeals to you, well, check them out. The website is lawo.com/twert. That'll tell them not only that you came here, that you went to them because you heard it here, which does us a big favor. It also takes you right to the radio gear at Lavo. So check them out. Thanks again, Lavo, for sponsoring the show. All right. We got just a couple minutes left in the show. And Chris Ark, tell us why ventilation and what you can do to prevent yourself problems with heat at remote sites out in the hot sun.
Oh, my goodness. Especially cut my teeth out in Arizona. That was maybe, aside from site checks, the biggest factor that I needed to get figured out is, where am I going to be and is this equipment going to be cool enough to operate properly? I've seen ISDN units, mixing consoles just start doing some crazy erratic things because it's just choked of any ventilation, and that heat gain that, it totally throws off the equipment. So, you have to ask yourself, does this equipment have enough ventilation to operate properly in its working environment? So when I have the ability to do so, I try to leave 1 RU rack spacing in between my equipment. Now, if you're flying with equipment, having that spacing might add 2 or 3 more flight cases onto your itinerary, and that's the last thing you want to do. So say that you don't have the ability to have that 1 RU separation. I try to install on the very top row of my rack an inline fan that can help pull air across that equipment and get rid of that heat. The other thing that I'll do is if I don't mind putting a hole in my SKB case, I'll actually cut a hole in the very top, then install debris, a little guard in there, so that air can exhaust right out of the top. If that isn't an option, hopefully your case has rear rack rails where you can install a fan horizontally to literally draw the heat right away from the equipment. It's really whatever your comfort level is, but I can't stress enough, make sure your equipment is properly ventilated if you want it to work properly, especially in the digital realm. I mean, it's a computer. If components can shut down and stop operating properly if they're just 200 degrees, it doesn't work that well.
So it sounds like you're really implying that active cooling, that is making sure air is forced or pulled through a rack system, is really key. Don't just leave it to convection cooling.
Correct. No, you need to be active in that and actually sucking air away. Just to leave it, just to let it breathe on its own. Even if you have 1 RU spacing, sometimes that case can still get really, really hot. There's been times where I've been out on site where I've scrambled to the general manager's office to get, a little desk fan to put behind the rack just to try to draw away whatever heat that I could. Same can be said in the live mixing environment, because I'm mixing in audio and performances in a tent, and the bridge of that audio console gets so hot that you can barely touch it. So, in the digital realm, especially, make sure that you're actively trying to mitigate heat gain.
In today's age, it's not expensive to go get yourself one of those pop-up tents, one of those, canopy covers. If you're doing an outdoor concert or interviews outdoors, if you're at a sports game or a race, sounds like a great idea to at least provide some shade and not be in the direct sunlight. Sunlight provides 600 and plus watts of heating for every square yard. So that adds up in a few minutes.
Yeah, and be careful if anybody ever has the solution of using a swamp cooler to cool down your equipment. Water and electricity and equipment, that doesn't work out so hot sometimes.
The swamp cooler, is that the big fan with some air mist going through it? Is that what that is?
Exactly. Again, it's a kind of a keystone to Arizona, because it gets so darn hot out there that they go, put a swamp cooler in. It's like, well, you're blowing it right on my audio console. So it doesn't work out too well.
Wow. Hey, Chris Tobin, you got any last comments or any tip for us before we have to go?
Yeah, sure. Tips of the trade, tools of the trade for remote broadcasting. Here's one. This is a Shure tone generator, XLR on one end, 400 hertz tone. That's good for quickly testing on your inputs. Then there's the Q-Box, which has got a built-in speaker, and you can listen to the audio sources and destination. So if you're running around with multiple cables on site. Then there's also that condition, oh yeah, what if the cables are bad? How do I know? Well, you could do this particular brand. Yep. It's a Swiss Army. And you turn it on, notice the lights are in crazy position. And I press to see if my phase, my wiring is correct. And then look, it's a nice diagonal line. So these cables are working like they should. So that problem isn't there. And then last but not least, let's not forget, you're at a remote location, multiple cables everywhere. Odds are you're going to be mixed in with other people. Remember these? Yeah.
Yeah, Lordy, absolutely.
Okay, it's a number. Number your cables, okay? You'll probably be the only one who has numbers on his cable. And you could do the color tape approach if you want, but everybody does. But the numbers, you create your own system. So with these tools, you too can have a successful remote broadcast.
And if I might interject, one other piece of equipment that you want to have is a cable, a Cat 5, Cat 6 cable tester with you.
Oh, yes. Yes,
you know,
absolutely.
You could have your setup back at your back in your shop there and go, oh, my cables are working great. And it only takes one little kink to get that impedance off. And all of a sudden, you're not transmitting the way you should be. Cables can go bad. So make sure you have your tester and a good RJ45 repair kit with you.
Oh, so true. You hear it at this conference center in Riga. We were setting up on Sunday and Monday and a little bit on Tuesday, and we came across about six bad cables. And I'm thinking, no wonder the development guys are having trouble. This cable's bad. And you know what we did with the bad cables? We threw them away. They're in
hacked the ends off, throw them
garbage.
Away.
Absolutely. Oh man. Hey, guys, we got to go. We're just about out of time, and I so much appreciate it. Chris Ark, thank you for joining us. I hope that after you get to your new position in life, you find some good experiences, and you'll come back on the show and tell us about them.
Absolutely. The pleasure was all mine. I'm honored. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you. Chris Tobin, thank you for taking the time to be with us, and great advice on your tools for the trade for doing remote broadcasts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Trust me, it works. And just the equivalent would be Cat 5 cable testers and making kits. Absolutely.
Hey, you know what, Chris? If you wouldn't care, after the show's over, would you just send me a couple of links to some of the things that you just showed off there? I didn't get the names of them quickly enough, and I'd love to put them in our show notes.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, well, both Chris's. Yeah, if you have anything you want me to put in the show notes. Sorry. Yeah,
Chris's stuff is definitely one in there, too.
Good. Okay. Hey, we got to go. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, has been brought to you by the Telos Alliance. Be sure you go to telosalliance.com/opt-in. Thank you very much. You'll stay on our mailing list, and we can't email you anything without that. We really can't. We'll get in big trouble. And also thanks to Lavo at lavo.com/twert. That's lavo.com/twert. Thank you so much to Suncast, our producer, did a great bang up job today. Really appreciate you. And also to Andrew Zarian, who's the founder of the GFQ Network. Next week, we have a really interesting guest. Can't tell you much about it. I don't know much about it. We're going to find out about it. It's pretty cool, whatever it is. I know that's too cryptic by half, but it's going to be a good show. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.